You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Offscript, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weiner, Kent, the editor-in-chief of American Theater. I'm here with
Deep Tran, associate editor.
And Susie Evans, senior editor.
And we're back to talk about politics is one of our overarching themes. We're first going to talk a little bit about the new overtime rules, changes to the Fair Labor Standards Act that are going into effect in December, and what that means for arts nonprofits and specifically theaters. We have a couple stories on that, a brand new one that Deep just wrote, which is great. We're going to talk about that a little bit. Then we're going to talk about our politics issue, which is our September issue, which a lot of it came out online last week, and it's worth talking about the ways we wrote about theater and politics and are continuing to write about the intersection of theater and politics. And then we have a great interview, Deep, with
Derek Wang, who is a composer. He wrote this opera called Scalia Ginsburg about some justices that you may have heard of.
Right. Both of them opera fans, right?
Yes,
which is amazing. So that's a fun interview we're looking forward to. And then we'll be back with recommendations. So why don't we kick it off, Deep, with a little bit about overtime.
Yes, I spent overtime writing overtime.
We just dropped a sort of epic reported piece, which is a follow-up. I'll just say we should acknowledge. A couple weeks ago, we ran a piece about the overtime rules, which was entirely styled and angled as a sort of FAQ for managers of what are your options and how can you deal with these new overtime rules. And it was not a popular story with many readers because it seemed to be saying, here are all the ways you can go. Some of them could be paying people more or you could cut their benefits. And it was a great piece, Deep, but I feel like people, it was not intended to be like a cheat sheet, but people took it that way.
Well, I think because the issue of money is a fraught one in the theater. So whenever you get into a conversation that doesn't include paying people more as an option, I think there's going to be a lot of pushback.
Right.
And just a quick explainer on overtime.
Yes.
The Fair Labor Standards Act dictates that you have to pay someone overtime if they work more than 40 hours a week. And under the previous rules, the threshold for being paid overtime is $23,000. So if you made under $23,000 before this year, then you were eligible to be paid overtime.
Right.
If you made above that, you can work for 50 hours. That doesn't matter.
Right.
You don't get anything on top of that.
For salaried full-time
positions. For salaried full-time positions.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Not contractors. And in May, the Obama administration issued an update on the rules saying the threshold for overtime pay will now be about $47,000.
Yeah, 47.5. Yeah.
Yeah. And it will be going up every 3 years too. So in 2020, the threshold will be $51,000.
Right.
And it's completely fine if you don't work in the non-for-profit world because $47,000 is a typical starting salary. Well, not American Theater.
Well,
but
I mean, we're in the nonprofit, so
yeah, exactly.
We are part of the nonprofit's arts field ourselves. Yeah.
So, well, and also journalism as well. I don't really know very many.
The pretty standard starting salary in journalism is like $35,000.
$30,000.
I mean,
35.
It's true. I mean, one angle of this is that there was talk about nonprofits hoping there would be an exemption because they operate outside the profit motive, so they have to raise every bit of money in other ways. Some of it's earned income, but they have to also. So they were looking for an exemption, and it didn't come. This applies to all kinds of businesses. Over how many? What's the budget? 500,000.
They have to bring in 500,000 in earned revenue.
Right.
So
right.
Grants aren't applicable to that.
To be considered under this act, they have to bring in that much?
Yes. But there is an exemption to that because if an employee engages in what is called interstate commerce, then that employee has to be paid overtime,
right.
Even
no
if
no matter what the budget of the organization.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
And doing something like sending an email to someone out of state can be considered interstate commerce.
Or licking an envelope and put it on the or licking a stamp. Not the envelope. You lick the stamp.
Oh, no email.
Stamps are adhesive now.
Nobody licks stamps anymore. All right. So, those are some of the ins and outs of it. And, you know, it seems to me there's two issues which you illuminate really well in your, there's sort of layered issues that you illuminate well in your piece, which are, is particularly in the theater, there's those 80-hour work weeks, there's the 10 out of 12s, there's the tech week, which seems unavoidable for theaters. So there's no way around there being overtime involved there.
Not being overtime. There has to be overtime.
Right, exactly.
Tech week.
So it's a question of, are all those tech people going to get bumped up to the new threshold? Or the theater's going to budget for overtime? It's a lot of different options. I know that in your piece, some people, managers, are even saying getting rid of or eliminating 10 out of 12s. I don't know how you put up a show without the 10 out of 12s, but.
Right. Well, the piece is called, what price overtime ? So you
right.
can find that online. It's
yeah,
very
make sure
long
to read it. Yes.
And extensive. But the question is, because you are forced to pay people, and theater as an industry is founded on long hours for very low pay or none or sometimes no pay at all. And so when that has become a normalized practice and when funders require you to pay very little in overhead and put all of your money towards programming, where does a theater get money in order to pay people more?
Well, they have to make the case, as your piece points out, to make the funding priority, not just programming, not just beautiful buildings, not just great plays and fantastic art. It has to be about the people involved and the workload. It's just not considered a sexy fundraising pitch to say we need more money for our staff. And it needs to be. It needs to be a priority. But that seems to be the only way, especially in the nonprofit world. I think the theater industry in general is not necessarily founded on cheap labor. It's pretty well unionized in a lot of fields. But that's commercial theater. And nonprofit theaters also has union agreements, many of them. But again, the nonprofit, I've just been reading some Zelda Fitchandler, and she makes the point was made a lot at our conference too, that a lot of people look at nonprofit as just a business that's just not making enough money. And nonprofit it's a different thing. It's for a civic good. It's not just non-something, it's for something else. So if people don't believe in the civic good of not just the art being made, but people making a living at it, then it's going to be hard to fund it.
Well, the problem is that people believe so much in this thing that they're doing and in making the art that they've been able to justify sacrificing their
yeah.
salaries and sacrificing the hours. And so what's happened is all of the money goes to art and programming and
right.
buildings, but none of it is, almost very little of it is going actually towards paying labor and
or
so,
like staff retention. Like you think of people yeah. like can get that much when they're 22, but if they want to start a family in their 30s, they can't stay in the field.
Exactly. Like
right.
I spoke, one of my sources, like he's about to get married and he makes $35,000 a year as a tech person at People's Light in Pennsylvania. And he was talking to me about, I didn't add this into my article, but he was talking to me about how sometimes he won't leave the theater until 1 a.m.
Right.
And then he can only afford to live like an hour outside of Philly.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's getting back home at 2, but then
right.
he has to wake up at 5 in order to get to the theater at 6
right.
for tech week. And so that's not a sustainable lifestyle. And so when you get up to like being 40 or 50 years old and wanting a family, like who would be able to sacrifice that much of their lives for it?
Right. Seems like what's again, it's go back to the theme of we're just mourning the death of Jim Houghton and Zelda Fitchandler. Two great leaders who had a vision for something that wasn't there before, and they convinced funders. In the case of Jim, it was about playwrights, but also, not to be overlooked, patrons, getting people to fund the idea that tickets should be cheap, right? I'm not saying Jim was not for artist compensation either, but if you had a leader whose mission was artist compensation, I think Oscar leans that way, Oscar at the Public leans that way a little bit. He also talks a lot about free tickets too. If you had a leader who made that his mission or her mission, that would be amazing. And that seems like what we might need to do is like have a moral case for better compensation.
Well, but artist compensation is different than staff compensation.
Well, yeah, we're blurring those. I know. Actually, I think that's the next step is to talk about artist compensation, talk about people who are not even part of this act, but that's a whole other conversation.
Well, the problem is because these theaters are being forced to pay their staffers more no matter what,
yeah,
then one of the sacrifices may have to be holding on increasing artists' fees. And so that money has to come from somewhere, and they can't fundraise all of it, not within a 5-month period.
Well, that is true. It's true, as Amy Retcher points out at American Shakespeare Center, that this does seem like, for to many nonprofits who maybe either weren't paying attention or didn't think it would happen or thought they would get an exemption, this is a sudden thing. As compared to, as she points out, minimum wage, and like in Seattle, they're ramping it up over a certain amount of time so that people don't.
Yeah, and New York too, we're getting it ramped up to 15, but right. It's going to be like right. A 2-year period.
So people can account for their budgets. Some theaters, again, I think we'll see a big hit to their bottom line. You know, I feel like some provisional adjustment has to be made in the short term, but I'm hoping, as your piece points out, that this kind of discussion, this kind of change, which often comes from outside, whether it's a union, like in L.A., which for the
well,
all
even
all
though
problems,
in L.A., they're these actors are asking to not get paid more, though. So there's conversation about like art versus livelihood.
Yes.
And how it seems to be like a contrast.
It has to come at, but whether the push is coming from an outside regulation or a union, hopefully this kind of thing forces people to think about more long-term solutions rather than short-term moving the money around now. So we have to hold off on this because the idea that you could raise more money for specifically to fund, again, salaries and retention, you know, is something that I think is, it should be the next moral cause for the theater.
Yeah, right? And there was also that piece and bit in your story about that one woman who like 20 people applied for a job and she knew she was replaceable. So like, why ask for more money or like right. Why pay them less? Because a lot of people want the job in the theater, which
well,
is another
there's that.
Issue.
Yeah, I mean, and if you raise compensation, I don't know if that makes the jobs even more desirable. Right?
Yeah.
But it's a really good piece, and we are gearing up to do a February issue. I think we can announce this.
Yeah.
On money, in all its aspects, including we'll probably touch on compensation. We'll probably touch on development, fundraising, on
artist
ticket prices, all that exciting
all
stuff.
That fun.
Everything stuff. To do with money, right? We're just going to print it on money. No,
we
we're
should
not.
Like send it to investment banks and be like, give us more money.
Yeah,
basically. Now I think Rob and I were joking that it'll just be like 3 spreads of like pay people more, like repeat
yeah,
it over.
Pay
and over.
People more.
Hey, that would be easy. That would give us less work. You wouldn't have to pay overtime. So.
Oh yes, it would be cheaper for us to produce.
Yeah, we have to figure it out too here at TCG.
How much money can we spend on our money issue? Is yeah. the question. So anyway, that's definitely worth reading, and you can also check out the original piece too and see if it pisses you off or not. But I think it's we're covering all the angles if we can. So speaking of politics, there's an election going on this year. You might have noticed. We definitely noticed. And we did a special issue on stuff related to the election, essentially. We thought of different takes. We thought about doing pieces about plays about politics. And we do have a roundup of those 19 shows at various theaters around the country that are on political themes. And also a story about plays about abortion, specifically Roe and Dry Land, but also a sort of a history by Carrie Purcell about
it's a hot issue this election.
Well, yeah, I think every election it's on the top of people's checklists. So our signature piece, I think, is there are two big ones. There's Michelle Volansky has this great piece where she's a dramaturg who got credentialed to go around and follow the primaries. And she writes about the sort of theater in the room with these various candidates, everyone from Ted Cruz to John Kasich to Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and, of course, the other guy, Donald Trump, who is also the subject of Mike Daisy's new one-man show, The Trump Card, and the piece he writes for us about looking at Trump as a performer, not unlike himself, a person who goes out there with a few notes and then riffs, is basically what Mike Daisy does and also what Donald Trump does. And then online we have a bunch of other stories. Oh, and also our production notebook on Hillary and Clinton, Lucas Nath's interesting-sounding new play about the 2008 election, a key moment in that election when Hillary...
Right well, before Hillary...
An alternate Hillary conceded to Obama. Yeah, yeah. So it's fascinating stuff. I don't know if we want to talk any more about other political developments or about those stories.
Yeah, talk about your story, Susie, that you're talking writing.
Talk about the one you're
The
you're,
one that I'm writing?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I feel like I should lead in with my personal story.
Do it.
She has a personal connection to this.
I have a personal connection to this politics issue. It's kind of a fun story. I probably will milk it at cocktail parties until I die. But I went to see the revival of The Crucible on Broadway, the Ivo van Hove production. And I sat in front of Billy Crystal when I went to see it, which was very exciting. I didn't know it was Billy Crystal till the show was over, but, you know, he was there. He looks the same person, blah, blah, blah. My parents really, really love Billy Crystal. So I texted my parents. I was like, oh, I sat in front of Billy Crystal at the Crucible. They texted me back immediately. My dad goes, oh, you know that your, like, ninth generation great-great-grandmother was convicted of being a witch in a Salem jail and died there at the age of 73. And I was like, what? I was like, what? And then the next text is, also, Sarah Palin is a direct descendant from this woman. Your sixth cousins.
Wow.
So.
Well, I know who got all the brains in the family.
Boom. Whoa.
Literally, like, within 5 minutes, I find out not only am I a descendant of a convicted witch, but I'm also sixth cousins with Sarah Palin.
I don't know which is worse.
I don't know which is worse. Yeah. I don't know. So it led me to thinking a lot about how, like, women are perceived by the media and but particularly by men or like powerful women. A lot of like the Salem witch trials, you know, men were scared of these women. And so they kind of used the witch as an excuse and, you know,
right.
Sarah Palin. And so anyway, this is all to say I wrote a little op-ed, which will be coming out tomorrow when this podcast is up. So about the production of An American Daughter up at Williamstown Theater Festival, which is a Wendy Wasserstein play that premiered at Lincoln Center in 1997 that I had never seen or read before. But, you know, it's about a woman who has just been nominated to become the Surgeon General of the United States and gets caught up in a big media scandal. And, you know, it sounds very familiar. And so it has a lot to do with, you know, media scrutiny and like how her husband views her and how the men in her life view her. And it feels extremely current, and it kind of related a little bit to this idea of me being like, I'm related to a witch and Palin, and like these women who are like sort of like criticized. So,
right.
And that's like a big topic in politics this season, you know, with, you know, our first female nominee from a major political party.
Yeah.
Being, and I mean, say what, I mean, I'm not trying to like get political on like what my opinion are on either candidate, but like,
well, you can do say that.
I can do that. I mean, I'm, you know, a supporting Hillary, not Trump. Big surprise. But a lot of the criticism about Hillary has been about like appearance and like the expensive Armani jacket that she wore,
right.
Like the way she like delivers a Beyonce joke or like a Pokemon Go joke or like
or her laugh or her tone.
I think Jimmy Kimmel voice, like did this funny thing where he like mansplained to her how
That was good
how
that
to do
good.
It and it was basically like there she couldn't win and that this play that Wendy Wasserstein wrote. It's not a perfect play, but like it feels so, it just felt like it was written yesterday. And I was like, really? A play that was written 20 years ago feels like it was written yesterday? Is this how far we've come?
So 97, that was not long before she died.
She died in early 2000.
Oh, okay. I thought it was, and then, but, okay, so that wasn't one of her last ones, but.
No, her last one was something.
If it was 97, that's right around.
Lewinsky.
It was inspired by Hillary when she was first lady.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think it was. I haven't found that written down anywhere, but I feel like I've heard that.
It sounds to me like if it has her husband's, the Surgeon General's nominee's husband's behavior as part of it, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, I mean, you know, that's Clinton, classic Clinton stuff.
But her husband's not a politician in the play.
Right. Okay.
You know, they live in Georgetown, but yeah, there is, you know, a tryst of behavior that feels Clinton-esque with her husband.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess there's a play going up in Chicago about Hillary as well. Another one, I forget.
A different one than Hillary and Clinton. One of the first pieces I ever wrote for American Theater was like Hillary the Musical or something like
that. Oh, right. I remember that. Yeah. I think there's been so much about Trump. You know, understandably, in this election, I think that the phenomenon of Hillary and the way she's been treated and how she's handled it over these many decades. It's fascinating to go back to videos of interviews of her in the 90s and watch her get asked the same questions and the way she handled them then, the way she handles them now.
Did you see that like montage of sexist questions that she got?
Yeah. It's, Yeah, I don't even know what to say. It kind of stops you in your tracks to think about it.
I mean, the play even gets into the idea, I think I opened with this, of like internet scrutiny, because the internet was kind of nascent in the 90s, and like chat rooms then, like comment sections now, like people just like going crazy to town on these people.
Yeah.
Oh, and speaking of Hillary, I just wanted to point out that Actors Equity endorsed a presidential candidate for the first time in its 103-year history.
Was it the first time ever?
Yeah, first time ever.
I mean, it's not the first time a union's endorsed candidate. They definitely do that, although it's controversial.
Yeah, well, it's the first time Equity has endorsed.
First time Equity's endorsed a candidate. Well, yeah, and I think they gave justification a lot of media organizations, other people are giving for being more upfront with their opinion. I mean, I think it was the Washington Post, which endorsed very early. Usually newspapers will endorse but their justification for endorsing Hillary early was just that Donald Trump's unacceptable.
Now, well, also something that was interesting, there's also a piece for this political issue, that's a conversation between Dan Coyce at Slate and Matt Hoved at Second City, because they have a new sketch show called Unelectable You, kind of about the election. And
so Unelectable You.
Unelectable
yeah,
You.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What did I say?
Unwatchable You.
I did?
I think so.
I think she said it right the first time.
Oh, really? I'm sorry. I can't hear correctly. Unhearable You. All right.
Anyway, so Dan said that Slate tells its audience who every single writer is voting for.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know that. I thought that was interesting.
I've seen that feature. I don't know that they require everyone to say, but yeah, they definitely are out front with it. It's an interesting, I mean, you know, not to try to change the subject a bit, but it's an interesting time for the way politics is practiced. I mean, that's certainly one way to put it. And I think it's interesting I don't think, for instance, Mike Daisy's case is airtight that it's all about theater and performance, but I think that's a big part of it. The ways in which the Republican nominee, whose name I don't like to say very much, has resonated with audiences, and the way he's received, because there's a lot of, he might make the point, there's a lot about like, oh, he lies, and fact checking, we have to fact check him, and I feel like he's saying that people aren't as stupid as we think. They're not actually believing what he's saying. They see it as a performance. They don't really literally believe what he says. In fact, you talk to them and say, well, I don't really agree with that. Or like, yeah, he says some crazy stuff, but what they buy is the performance of his like authentic.
He's not that charismatic self on stage, though.
Have you seen him live?
Yeah, not live. I've seen him on TV.
I've seen his speeches. They're really painful to listen to.
They're so painful.
Right. Well, I can't really defend them.
Yeah, but I do agree with Mike, and I was going to recommend his show, which I will talk more about after.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I do agree with Mike in that politics has become almost like a performance, because we all know that politicians lie, and so we're just all buying into this image of themselves that they're giving to us. And for most non-college educated people, they're just buying it wholesale and not really thinking too hard about it. And so that's how certain politicians are able to influence constituents into voting against their best interest.
Yeah, I mean, something else that was interesting that Dan and Matt said to me in a conversation about the Second City show was that they were basically like, Hillary's playing a role that she would not get cast as. That was like a really profound quote, because like, she's trying to put up this face that she's presidential and in charge and, you know,
but also relatable.
And relatable. And she,
yeah, I feel like the in charge thing is something that she would be cast as in terms of actually getting shit done. But like in terms of being like, hey, how you doing?
Like, get a beer with.
Exactly.
That's
once again, I never understood why that was a requirement for a president. I don't want a president that is partially a frat boy. I want a president who can get the work done.
Yeah, but like Obama's somebody you want to hang out with. He's a cool guy, right?
Yeah, yes, but that's not the number one thing that you should be looking for.
But that's what most presidents have like run on. Like,
exactly. That relatability factor.
A part of it. That's a big part of it.
It's a public position. It's a celebrity role.
Yeah.
Some actors aren't good actors, but they've got charisma.
Alexander Petri, who I also did an interview with, who I love, who's a Washington Post critic. I think she's the one. Maybe it was someone else who made the joke Hillary's kind of awkward with public presentation, and she mentions that, like, well, good thing the presidency has nothing to do with public presentation. Like, you know, it's obviously it does. I think, you know, in the normal realm of politicians, take away the fact that she's a woman, she's a pretty good politician. She's gotten some things done. She's not as good as her husband or Obama in terms of that connection with people, but she's better than John Kerry. You know, she's as good as John McCain. She's as good as a lot of people who've run for president. I don't really see. I think a lot of the other stuff that's layered upon her, it has a lot to do with Clinton baggage, and then of course the woman thing. People just aren't used to. There's unconscious bias in people like, I would vote for a woman, but just not this one. Something's wrong. There's just something wrong about her I don't like. You know,
And you're like, what?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a double-edged sword of her being around for so long. Like, she is really good at her job, so that's why she's had a longevity. But at the same time, you also get the feeling of, I've known you all of my life, and I don't like most of what I know about you. So why do you have to be the first woman?
And yet, career politicians often do better than she does. I feel like if you apply the same standards to other politicians who are men, right?
But that's the appeal of Trump, is he doesn't have that veneer of dishonesty, even though he is dishonest. Like, people fake face of authenticity that he presents that most politicians don't have.
Yeah, I do feel like that's one thing Mike talks about really smartly, is, and then that's one of the reasons he just mowed over his opponents in the Republican side, is just that he doesn't sound like a politician, because he is not. He doesn't sound practiced. He doesn't sound rehearsed. He shoots from the hip. People love that on some gut level, right? And
well, they watched his show for so many the last 10 years. So,
well, he's also a known quantity, at least as much as Hillary. Anyway,
yeah. They used to be friends too.
Yeah, he was very upset when he didn't get an invite to Chelsea's wedding.
Yeah.
He donates to the Clinton Foundation.
I was too. So, lest we turn into the Slate Political Gab Fest, we have an interview. We should probably segue to Derek Wang, composer of Scalia Ginsburg.
Yes.
A new opera.
It got its world premiere at the Castleton Festival last year, and it's going to be at Glimmerglass next year.
So is Scalia bass? Just tell me that. Is he a bass? Do you know?
What do you mean?
Is written for a bass voice, Scalia?
You're talking about a tenor.
Whoa.
Yeah. Okay, Scalia would be a baritone if he was in...
Right.
He said he would be a baritone, because the fun thing is, Derek got to perform this opera for Scalia and Ginsburg at the Supreme Court. Like, in front of them.
Wow. What? I want to hear this interview. Anything other setup we need?
Yes, the other setup is, and we're going to let you listen to about 10 seconds worth of the music. And I had this setup that Derek sent me that Justice Ginsburg wrote.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, in the preface to Scalia Ginsburg. You can find a link to it on our website.
Nice.
Basically, she said, Scalia Ginsburg is a comic opera with an important message brought out in the final duet. We are different, we are one. And so you will be hearing that duet now. Enjoy.
We are different. We are one.
Well, thank you for sitting down with us, even if it's just over the internet. The first thing I feel like I have to ask, which are you, Republican, Democrat, Independent?
Oh, wow. That's a way to open a podcast. I'm going to decline that one, very much because I think in terms of the spirit of Scalia Ginsburg, the opera, the important thing isn't to focus on people's political preferences or sort of the way they might, have biases coming in. Either to see the show or listen to the music or even evaluate the legacies of Justices Ginsburg and Scalia. And so I think in the spirit of that, I'm going to have to decline that particular question.
Well, but what I find so fascinating about, I mean, I just read the opera. I haven't been able to listen to it. But what I find fascinating is just like these people being able to like get past their differences in order to be friends. And so I feel like it's a valuable thing right now to learn how to be, I guess, bigger than your beliefs.
I quite agree with that. I think it's very important. And it's interesting to me as well, even in my own life, interacting with people, to ask myself, how much do I know about this person and what they believe? How much am I attributing to them, you know, because of, you know, the way they talk or the way they dress or their job they have or something of that nature? And then in the end, you know, how much does it matter? You know, how many of my decisions am I going to make about an individual that I'm interacting with, you know, based on either, you know, what they declare about themselves or what I attribute to them versus, you know, what I perceive just from interacting with them, you know, the kind of person they are, their character, their behavior. And so I think the example of the friendship between Justices Scalia and Ginsburg is, you know, an example to us all in that way.
Right. I feel like there's I live in New York City, but I feel like there's a sense of we're so surrounded by hardcore liberals that I feel like whenever someone admits to being something that's not that, or at worst admits to being a Republican, I feel like there's an intake of breath of, oh my God, how do you exist? I don't understand people like you.
Right. Well, I lived in New York as well and working in theater, as well. And so I get where you're coming from as far as that's concerned. And one of the interesting things about spending time in the law is that that has enabled me to get out a little bit of the, you know, of the arts or theater bubble and to interact with lots of different people. And for example, you know, and learn about the jurisprudence of people like Justice Scalia, who might not be, you know, everyone's cup of tea. And so that's been fascinating to me. And of course is reflected probably in the multiple footnotes to the opera libretto. So there's that.
Right, right. Well, just for our listeners who don't quite know the synopsis, I'll just give a short answer and maybe you can add anything in that you feel is relevant. It's about Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg who are trapped in the room together by a statue that comes to life, and they have to reach an agreement on the, I guess, their interpretation of the Constitution and whether it's a living document or a document in stasis. And if they can agree, then they can get out of the room. Is that accurate?
I think that's pretty close to the mark. I think the only thing I might add is that because it is a gentle and loving parody of things operatic and legal, that the plot, as you describe, the trials they go through, they have to go through three trials of character, defending their legal views, justifying what they've said and written in order to get out. And that, of course, is a loving tribute to operas such as The Magic Flute, where characters have to go through trials and get out. You know, statues coming to life, that's Don Giovanni. If I summarize the opera a little more, you know, Justice Scalia is alone, so the statue comes to life and seals Justice Scalia into the Supreme Court and traps him, which is a reference to Aida, which mm-hmm. is where a character is punished by being, you know, sealed in a chamber.
And buried alive, then, yeah.
And then Justice Ginsburg breaks in to try to rescue him, which is a reference to the opera Fidelio, right, where the lead female is breaks into a prison, you know, to free a prisoner. And so, you know, so it's a lot of fun there. But I think you've basically, you know, you've summed it up.
Oh, I do love that quote she said when she broke in, saying, "This isn't the first time I've had to break through a ceiling."
Oh yeah, that was fun to write. And also because there is this great operatic tradition of strong female characters emerging, you know, sort of breaking through and entering the room. So the Queen of the Night in The Magic Flute, or Erda in Wagner's Rheingold, you have these historic and famous moments in opera where this happens, and it made sense in the context of this plot to have Justice Ginsburg do that as well.
Right. Well, and I listened to your TED talk that you gave at TEDx Broadway earlier this year, and you talked about writing from this concept of operatic precedence, where you incorporate both text from Ginsburg and Scalia's judicial decisions, as well as references to opera's past. So can you tell me a little bit about why that was the approach, or how?
Sure. I would love to tell you about this because, you know, to be fair, often in interviews, it's, you know, it can get a little bit obscure, and then, you know, people want to hear more about other features of the opera, and then I always geek out about operatic precedent, you know, and so it depends where you are, you know, if you're, I was doing a lecture recital for, you know, Stanford Law School and the Stanford Arts Institute, and so there, you know, there are faculty members on the stage, I'm like, okay, I'm going to take, you know, a couple minutes for a digression about operatic precedent, and you're all just going to have to sit through it because this is a university and, you know, you're supposed to know about these things. So here we go.
Holistic education. Then, that's what it's all about. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, being interdisciplinary, that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
But sure. Talking about operatic precedent. Well, I think for me, from the standpoint of, you know, of a writer, what's fascinating to me is when subject and medium can really merge. And so to have the idea, however improbable, of writing an opera about constitutional law and about Supreme Court justices was one thing. And then the question was, you know, how to bring that to life, how to execute it. And I wanted to be particularly careful that it wasn't just a matter of saying, hey, this is something that's just kind of in the news, so I'm going to riff off of that. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be truer to the spirit of the material, which of course were these statements by the Supreme Court justices. And so I thought, well, what if there were a way to create a piece of, you know, music theater, of opera, where as an audience member, you would almost get a theatrical sense of what it's like to engage with the law and with constitutional law. And of course, interpreting the Constitution has so much to do with precedent, has so much to do mm-hmm. with engaging with a decision, you know, someone decided was the best decision, or some group of people decided was the best decision 100 or 200 years ago, and then living with the consequences of that and working within that. And so much of Anglo-American law is, you know, is based on that idea of precedent that I thought, well, wouldn't it be fun then to have the opera reflect so that virtually everything that is, you know, sung in the words or the music is somehow a reference or somehow reacts to something in the history of law and opera, and specifically the statements of these two justices. And of course, there's a whole other meta element where in my research, you know, I found out what big opera fans they were. So the idea of having mm-hmm. an opera about these people who, you know, knew so much about opera and then have it refer to all these operas, it was too tempting to resist.
Right. And then it worked out because in the NPR interview you did, Justice Scalia and Ginsburg talked about, you know, what voices they would be and how he would be a baritone, she'd be a soprano. And so there's that depth of knowledge there that I think, like, you really hit on.
Yeah, well, that was one of the great things, because in terms of their reaction to it, you know, which was very kind, I was gratified that they, of all people, you know, they would have both the legal and the opera chops to really, you know, appreciate and to think about sort of what I was going for.
What's so funny is, like, okay, and also just to add, that's why there's a lot of footnotes in the libretto, because you're referencing back to where you get the source from, which is really helpful for law nerds. But what was interesting to me when I read it was it kind of reminds me of Hamilton. I mean, granted, everyone's talking about Hamilton, but there's in Hamilton there's references to, you know, other musicals and the Constitution, the founding documents and the letters that the founding fathers wrote. And so I feel like there's this level of, you can enjoy it on the surface as a piece of work, but if you know a lot about this one thing, like opera or rap or legislative history, then you'll get even more enjoyment out of it.
Oh, I quite agree with that idea of having these layers of references, because as a writer, one can get inside one's own head sometimes a little too much. And then the risk is that, you know, how dense do you want the surface of something to be? And that's a question I also encountered in my music training as well, studying classical music, both older and more contemporary. So the fascinating idea that you could create something that's enjoyable to experience sort of as a novice, or, you know, for your first time, watching it or listening to it. But then if it's enjoyable enough that you want to return to it, and then the more you explore it, you know, the more sort of hidden treasures there are, I think it's a fun way to write, at least, because then I find that I'm able to provide so many more levels of experience than I might otherwise be able to. So yeah, I quite agree.
Yeah. Talking about the law, being a lawyer, how did you go from having 2 degrees in music to deciding you wanted to go to law school?
Well, I think it was a matter of wanting to expand the scope of my knowledge, for one thing. I had a specific interest when I was studying law, which was intellectual property, of course, which is the stock and trade of, you know, writers and composers, mm-hmm. and lyricists, things of that nature. But I think also there was this larger sense of wanting to connect the music and the lyrics that I was writing to something in the wider world in a very deep way. And I think being interdisciplinary in that way, that was the spark that started the Scalia Ginsburg Opera, of course. And I find that having this education in the law has, you know, significantly sort of expanded my conception of, you know, of what's possible as a writer. Hence, you know, crazy opera about constitutional law, right? So, so there's that. It's been gratifying to be able to find more or new audiences, both for opera and theater, but also for the Supreme Court and its issues. Because what I found through Scalia Ginsburg was that there were people I knew in the law community who had, you know, never been to the opera or rarely been to the opera or rarely been to theater, but they said, you know, when this show comes, you know, because it's about what it's about, like, I definitely want to see it. And so they, especially because the world premiere was not far from DC, you know, there was a contingent of folks in the legal world there who came, and it was great to have that. And on the flip side, I've had people who were maybe somewhat interested in politics, but not necessarily as much with the Supreme Court, in the music and the arts community, engage with this opera. And at least, you know, I'm not claiming to have led them to a better understanding of anything, but on the other hand, you know, there are over 200 footnotes that they can consult if they want to know where something comes from. And maybe even more than that, one of the best experiences I had was from a fellow law school classmate
who said,
you know, I always sort of just dismissed anything I read about Justice Scalia, but, you know, after this opera, I think I'm going to read it more carefully and engage with it more deeply and pay more attention to what he had to say, you know, regardless of whether I agree with it or not. And I thought, well, you know, that's maybe one of the highest compliments I've gotten about this piece.
Oh, so just out of curiosity, I mean, are you practicing now? Because I know you took the bar.
Oh, wow. So you have done your homework. Well, that was, I mean, taking the, I mean, that was interesting because I was invited to present excerpts from Scalia Ginsburg at the Supreme Court. Right after graduating from law school. So it was the middle of studying for the bar exam. So I had to, my big study break from the bar exam, you know, if you're doing one of those preparation courses, you know, you have people who sort of check on your progress. I'm like, sorry, I can't do anything today. I have to go down to the Supreme Court, you know, my best excuse ever. I mean, still not an excuse not to study, but,
I think that's a good one.
I mean, in the end, they were like, okay. Yeah, you know, just this once, we'll let you off. You know, it'll be okay. So, I went and presented there. It was the day after the Windsor decision, actually. And then of course, when the story came out, it was still 3 weeks before the bar exam. And so I had to basically, you know, with the other press interest, I kind of had to have people say, you know, PR rep or whatever, say, hey, you know, Derek's kind of busy right now, so maybe wait to interview him. And it's like, well, why is he so busy? Well, he's taking the bar exam. So, and so that everyone waited, they were patient. I took the bar exam, and then, you know, they found me that right the day after, and, you know, said, okay, we're going to talk to you about things. And of course, because they had to wait, my taking the bar exam was, you know, it was part of all those reports. So everyone reading any of these articles knew that I had taken the bar exam months before I, you know, was going to find out whether I had passed. So it was, you know, just ever so slightly nerve-wracking. and at that point, I had to ask myself, at least right now, you know, at this moment, fresh out of school, are you going to sort of leave this opera aside and, you know, kind of go into a traditional law practice and have that kind of lifestyle, or kind of pursue this crazy, you know, uncertain, fascinating project and see where it's going to go? And I said, you know what? I think I'm going to have to follow where this opera leads me, because, you know, how many times in your life do you get to write an opera about constitutional law that Supreme Court justices, you know, are interested in, right? So I said, yeah, let's do that. That's my very long-winded way of saying I am not currently practicing. But I haven't ruled it out entirely. I mean, the law is still a fascinating thing, but you know, the journey of this opera has been so fascinating and gratifying, and has allowed me to engage with the legal world in ways that I might not have otherwise.
Right. And I think it'll be a good enough piece on your resume if you ever want to eventually officially practice.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, one hopes, you know. You know, it is about the law after all, and I have demonstrated that I can research and write, you know, long footnotes. So
right. So I assume, because you're an arts person, that you have a strand of progressiveness in you. So I'm just wondering, because, like, you really had to dive deep into the character of Scalia writing this piece, and so did you find, like, did it help you understand this very divisive man better?
Well, I think so. There are his writings and speeches to begin with. There's biographical material about him as well. And all of that was helpful in getting a sense of who he was and what he believed. And then, of course, I think more as a general rule from a writing perspective, that it's not my job to take sides before writing the piece. And that as an audience member, and I don't know, you know, you may have experienced this as well in your theater going life, where sometimes you go see something, you know, this, I mean, I could use the easier example of, like, I guess certain news outlets or something, where you can kind of, you know, pick which echo chamber you want. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, you know, you'll go see a play or something, and it's very well-meaning, but because you kind of know the author has made her or his case very clear, like, from minute one, and, like, what side they're on, you're like, okay, like, you know, hopefully there are some surprises along the way, but please don't beat me over the head with your message, you know, for the next 90 minutes. I think in this sense, fascinatingly enough, a law education kind of helps with that approach to drama, because, of course, legal training teaches you to analyze a case or a situation from all perspectives and give them all weight. You know, even if you end up taking one side or another, you still have to be able to see what everyone's motivation is. And so, mm-hmm. in this sense, writing the opera, you know, Scalia Ginsburg, therefore, I don't know that there was too much of a struggle. Because, you know, every character is a character with his or her motivations and goals. As far as, you know, empathizing with each character, well, as far as Justice Scalia was concerned, you know, I think if one thinks really hard enough, you know, one can always find a connection to each character that one writes. And so, for example, let's say with Justice Scalia, certainly he had the experience of his father coming from overseas and building a life for himself in the, mm-hmm. in the States. And I think that was, you know, that was something, you know, my parents came from overseas as well and, you know, built a life for themselves in the States. And so I think that is one example of, you know, a point of empathy, that I could explore with the character. And it was one that I thought was worth exploring enough to write an entire aria about. And I think it's one that Justice Scalia appreciated as well, because, you know, in presenting for him and Justice Ginsburg at the court, he took me aside afterwards to comment specifically on the excerpt about his father. And so I think he appreciated that. And for that, reason, I think, you know, I think in a theatrical context, if you're an audience member and you are, and you come in and you are, you know, pro one character all the way and anti another character all the way, hopefully, if I've done my job right, you know, by the end of the show, you won't feel exactly the same way. But who knows, you know, who can fathom the human mind?
Right. Well, especially in the current media climate where it's just turning politicians into caricatures of themselves for our digestions. So I think it's also, yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. It can be a little dispiriting sometimes because I think, well, you know, do I really need to click on all of these links? You know, at this point, I kind of know where the story's going to go. You know, it's a difficult time, but I think this is a time that gives us, just as individuals, as people, the opportunity and the potential to discover for ourselves who we are, you know, what we believe in, and how we relate to people who disagree with us. I mean, this is kind of the perfect, you know, environment to test that, right?
Right. Well, considering the divisiveness in which the rhetoric, general political rhetoric that's happening right now, and especially with the Supreme Court, do you think it's given your this piece that you wrote to a couple of years ago, like, more resonance or different resonance?
Well, I think there's certainly the context has changed perhaps a little bit. The fact that, you know, there is impactful news happening with the Supreme Court, you know, therefore creates more fascination with the Supreme Court. And so I can't imagine how that wouldn't affect perception of the opera. I had been making, you know, updates as I was writing, the piece. And so, for example, last year, before the world premiere at the Castleton Festival, in Virginia, that was on, I believe, July 11th, 2015. And so, as you are probably well aware, the Supreme Court term ends around the end of June. Mm-hmm. So there were all these very important decisions coming out, you know, in the final weeks of rehearsal. And so given the less than perfect cellular reception in the countryside at a festival of this kind, you know, I'd be going around trying to find a signal, loading the latest Supreme Court opinions from wherever I was, you know, reading them, thinking, is this going to completely invalidate the opera? You know, luckily it didn't. But what happened was we were actually able to incorporate some bits from the very latest opinions last year into the world premiere, which I think was much appreciated. And with the with next year's production, you know, I'm not making any promises, because that would just be creating, you know, lots of extra work for myself that I would be committing to. But it's quite possible that there may be some further updates, you know, to, as you say, to take into consideration the changing context of what's going on around the Supreme Court.
Right. Well, that just kind of veers into, like, what I wanted to ask you to end this conversation, which is, you end the opera talking about the statue says he's going to go talk to John Boehner. And so now I'm wondering, is there a sequel with, you know, either with Paul Ryan or with the future justices that come, that take Scalia's seat?
One never knows. I mean, I think, you know, Scalia Ginsburg is, you know, it will always be the original of these things. I don't know what the demand is out in the wider world for, you know, for Supreme Court themed operas, but if someone really, really wants to make it happen, you know, give me a call. Yeah. Certainly. Oh, right. Of course, you know, regarding Speaker Boehner, once that his position had changed, you know, I thought, okay, you know, let's put a little sticky note in the script there, you know, we'll have to revisit that one, right?
So, yes.
So, I mean, such is the the curse of being somewhat contemporary or topical, which is, of course, then you are contextualized in your time. And I think, but I think and I hope that that some version of this piece will continue to speak to people, you know, even if or after the Supreme Court isn't sort of facing the same kind of attention that it is right now. But, you know, one never knows. You know, we create these things because we feel there is some need to create them. And you know, we hope that they go and have some life out there in the world. And that's really all one can ask.
Right. Well, I also feel like it's not just about the Supreme Court. It's also about just like ideology and not holding so fast to it that you become blind to what other people are thinking.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And I hope, you know, as I may have been hinting all along, I'm not one to deliberately try to beat anyone over the head with a message. But at the same time, you know, I think one big theme of this opera is that this friendship is an example to us that, hey, you know, there is a way for people, you know, to get past their differences, to get along, to even be close friends, and to, you know, to have a lot of fun doing it, you know, which is why the opera is, you know, one hopes, in practice as well, you know, is written as a comedy. You know, it's, I think, you know, sometimes life is a little too short to go on, you know, just to go on disagreeing and attacking and hating. And sometimes, you know, we have to appreciate each other, for who we are.
Right. Right. Speaking of, are you working on anything else right now?
I am working on some new projects. And so it's been, fun as it is to continue to be involved with Scalia Ginsburg, of course, the creative impulse asserts itself and one likes to work on new things. I mean, what I can tell you is that for Scalia Ginsburg, in addition, of course, to the production at the Glimmerglass Festival in mm-hmm. August 2017, next year, the libretto, or rather excerpts of it, are to be featured, I understand, in Justice Ginsburg's new book.
Oh my God!
My Own Words, which is an anthology of her writings, coming out in October. So that was, you know, that was a fun bit of news to learn. You know, I was like, hey.
Oh my God! Congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah. Oh, I do have a Justice Ginsburg at the Theater story, though, if you don't mind.
Sure, go for it.
Yes, and so you know how I wanted to talk with you and John Strand because he also wrote a play about Scalia.
Right.
And I saw it at Arena Stage a couple months ago, and there was a talk back, and they were like, and they said, Justice Ginsburg is in the audience tonight, and there she was. And so it was really touching that she was almost paying tribute to someone who she vehemently disagreed with most of the time, but was still a friend that she's still remembering.
Oh, definitely. So what you're saying is you were there that night.
Oh yeah, I was there. I saw her.
Oh, I was there too.
Oh my God!
Yeah. If you saw someone, I think I was probably very almost on the stage or something. So I didn't really have a good view of the audience. But yeah, who knew that we would have both been there. So
well, that was awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Take care.
And we're back with a few recommendations of things we're thinking about that you should see or read. Deep, why don't you start, since yours is a political recommendation?
Yes, it's all politics all the time until November 25th.
Not 25th, 5th.
I hope not the 5th.
5th, okay.
You think of Thanksgiving, where we forget about politics.
No, when politics is family time.
Okay, right, family politics. So what do you recommend to us, Deep? Surprise?
Surprise, no, maybe not. So on this past Sunday, I took my Republican boyfriend to the Trump Card by Mike Daisy at Joe's Pub.
Uh-huh.
And even though Mike was talking to liberals as his audience, yeah. I think it was my boyfriend, my Republican boyfriend, found it. He found that Mike made some really good points.
Yeah.
Especially in terms of why Trump is such a, is so popular among rural voters.
Hmm.
Because there's a really good portion where Mike basically said it's because they've been continually screwed over by a two-party system.
Hmm.
And if the decision is more inaction versus just burning the whole thing down, then we might as well go for a scorched earth policy at this point. So it's great. It's very bipartisan. You can take your family who you don't agree with to it, and you'll have a great conversation after.
But it's not playing in New York anymore.
It's playing.
So where is it playing? Seattle?
I don't know if Seattle, but I have.
There's one night in Seattle, I think. But
yeah, Seattle, the Guthrie in September, Theater Wit in Chicago, and Los Angeles.
Is Mike doing all this?
Yes.
It reminds me that there's a production at, there's a theater that's doing a full run of it in Chicago.
Theater Wit? That's
Theater
what
Wit.
I have.
Yeah, that's, Mike's not doing that run. I mean,
really?
That's a month. I don't think Mike is going to go to, maybe I'm wrong.
I wouldn't think Mike would do Theater Wit.
The other thing is, we should note that the entire text of the Trump card is up at some point. It was supposed to have already been up, but it's at MikeDaisy.com. And people, it's an open source thing. Let's say his Agony and Exit of Steve Jobs was published online. You could just take it and perform it however you want.
No permission, no payment.
Sing it, set it to music, whatever.
Exactly. Make another opera about it.
So Mike doesn't make any money off of licensing.
On those particular shows. Mm. And I think for a certain time. And, you know, his thought, as he says in the piece, when he first started doing this, he didn't think Trump would even be the nominee, like a lot of people. And now, you know, I'm knocking for Micah here that this piece will not be relevant after November 5th.
Well,
I can recommend
the way
it too.
He closes it may be relevant it's a cult of personality thing that may replicate itself in the future.
Yeah, no, he makes the point that a lot of people have been making that Trump might have paved the way, opened the door for the next person who maybe not as blatantly unlikable.
Kanye, 2020.
Wow. not on my watch. All right. So, Susie, what have you got to?
I'm going to recommend, and I hope this is not what you're planning on recommending too. This weekend, the Public Theater is doing their annual Public Works Shakespeare, and it's the first summer that Lear de Bessonnet
is directing.
I'm seeing it Sunday.
It's Kwame Kwe Arma from Center Stage is directing, and instead of Todd Allman doing the music, Shayna Taub, who I love, is doing the music. And it's Twelfth Night, which is my absolute favorite Shakespeare play. And Nicky M. James is playing Viola. Andrew Kober is Malvolio. It's just going to be a great, great time. And they use a bunch of like members of the community. There's usually like at least 200 people in the production. I think one of the members of the community is playing Olivia this year. So like a big part. And it's just going to be very magical and fun. And it's four performances this weekend. So if you're in town, you should wait in line and get free tickets and enjoy your Labor Day some musical Shakespeare.
I have to get back on my calendar. I haven't seen a lot of stuff this summer, and I've reserved for that if I recall. Anyway.
You should probably check.
I love those Public Works things, not least because they remind me in a great way
of
Cornerstone's work. Yeah. Just really like.
They're very fun.
Taking a classic, adapting it very freely, and casting like huge amounts of community folks in it.
And I believe like Dallas and Syracuse is doing similar things.
Mm-hmm,
like
mm-hmm.
They're doing the, I know Dallas is doing the Lear de Bessonnet's version of The Tempest.
Right.
In a couple of weeks.
Yeah. This is the first time it hasn't been Lear, so I'm curious.
So what's Lear up to, I wonder?
She's doing that musical out in La Jolla.
Oh, yeah, right. That's
Kiara
right.
Hooda's new musical,
right,
Miss
okay.
You Like Hell, I believe.
Yeah. Okay. She's a rising star who deserves everything.
Well, we already put her on our cover, so she's not rising anymore.
She's a big star.
Yeah, I guess so. She continues to rise even higher. Mine will maybe put a capper on all of our Hamilton recommendations. This week is the last Ham for Ham show.
I think it just happened
today.
Right, that's
today.
What I said. This week. By the time this is published, it'll be over. And I just want to recommend and just sort of salute that as an amazing bit of street theater that persisted almost rain or shine. I know they didn't do it as much in the winter when it was cold, right?
They did Digital Ham for Ham.
Digital Ham for Ham. Anyway, it was some of the high points of the season. I think my And you can go, Howard Sherman has a YouTube page. You can just look up, type in Howard Sherman, Ham for Ham. That's H-A-M for the number four, Ham. And he's taped them all, and they're all up there. I would say my favorite is still the Three Kings singing the Skylar Sisters. That's a good one. Do you have other favorites you liked? I mean, the very last one was Renee Elise Goldberry singing a song that was cut from Hamilton. With Rory O'Malley
like a version of Satisfied, right? Sort of.
I confess that I did not listen to it, so I'm not sure where it's from. But
I listened to a part of it. It sounded similar to Satisfied.
Okay. So it's an early version of that.
I think one of my favorite ones was when Oak sang Let It Go, like Mickey Mouse. That was a good one.
My favorite one was...
So I think he sang Let It Go.
Yeah, he's still in it, too.
He's great.
He can still do it.
Yeah.
Well, my favorite one was when they had Kelly O'Hara and she rapped.
Yeah.
What song did she do?
She did like a 90s, I think it was like a 90s Busta Rhymes song.
Did she do The Worm?
No.
No, just kidding.
She did The Worm, though.
I know, we've talked about Kelly O'Hara and The Worm before.
Patti LuPone did it and let you film with your cell phone.
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder. It seemed like Lin-Manuel Miranda was the ringmaster of that, and it was his irrepressible
his
energy.
He let Rory do it for the summer. Rory took over for the summer to do it once a week.
To do right.
When they were first starting, though, it was every day.
Yeah.
It was just commitment, basically.
Yeah, there was enthusiasm that and I don't think he ever burned out on that. I mean, he had to move on to other projects, but. Yeah, anyway,
Disney.
It's an era that's gone. There's still a lottery that fans can gather for, but there'll be no show to entertain them while they wait.
The lottery is still digital, though. I think.
Yeah,
it's just digital.
Yeah.
They didn't crash.
It did when it first launched.
Okay,
I think
so the lottery's just digital. So there's basically no street action around Hamilton now.
Well, there's people sleeping on the street to get standby.
Okay.
Hiring people to sleep in the streets.
Which is
to get
now totally
replacement
illegal.
Cast is about to go in, right?
A lot of them are in.
A lot of them are already.
Lexi Lawson is.
Mandy Gonzalez is going on, right?
She's going in after Labor Day.
As Angelica.
Angelica.
Right?
Brandon Victor Dixon just went in as Burr.
Are they all going to get reviewed, I wonder?
I wonder. Well, I think they're waiting until it's like the whole cast. They don't have a new Washington
Chris
yet.
Chris Jackson isn't leaving, though, right?
No, he is. And Oak isn't leaving.
Okay, right.
And I don't think Anthony Ramos.
So you're saying this short. I didn't get Oak the first
leaving,
time. What's his full name? Can you say it?
Oak, you're ready. Oak, I don't know how to say his name. I apologize.
That's all right. No, it's okay.
He goes by Oak.
But he's Madison and Hercules and a bunch of other great parts. Yeah. Well, anyway, that's a little Hamilton nerd out for the moment, marking the passing of a wonderful.
Other shows should do it, though.
Yeah, I guess that's what I would say. That's all. My recommendation is other shows do it.
Or the Chicago Hamilton do it.
Or the Chicago Hamilton.
Yeah, do some street theater around your buzzy show. I don't know if every show could attract that kind of enthusiasm, but
Hamilton around the
country. I think if you have a lottery, there's probably enough people to watch it.
Yeah.
Wicked could do it.
From our mouths to God's ears. All right. On that note, another fine show comes to an end. Please like us on Facebook. Please like us on iTunes. Review us there. All the links to what we've talked about will be on the show page. Well, till next time, farewell.